There was a time in this race where I thought I had a very small market share when it came to who has the chance at winning this thing.
Dallas CV prepares to race for the win out of White Mountain. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, March 14th. Good evening. I'm Rachel Waldholtz. Also tonight, Donald Trump pleases environmentalists and angers the Alaska delegation with a position on federal lands.
We were shocked that he said that. On the one hand, it was good. On the other hand, it was surprising to hear that from Donald Trump.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
Condor Airlines, with nonstop service from Ted Stevens International Airport to Germany and beyond. More information available on condor.com. Condor, born to fly. Alaska Community Action on Toxics believes future generations have the right to clean water, clean air, and toxic-free food. Learn more by visiting akaction.org. This message sponsored by Alaska Community Action on Toxics.
Defending Iditarod champion Dallas Seavey is on his way this evening in pursuit of his fourth victory. He arrived in White Mountain at 9:48 a.m. for the mandatory 8-hour layover at the checkpoint, giving him a 5:48 p.m. departure time. His father, Mitch Seavey, was less than an hour behind. To the minute, Dallas is on pace with his record-setting run in 2014. KNOM's Emily Schwing caught up with the leaders in White Mountain.
The first team to pull into the second-to-last checkpoint on the 1,000-mile trail was Dallas Seavey.
Dallas Seavey, you come in at 9:48.
Awesome.
I need to check your mandatory gear.
Sounds good. Let's do that.
Seavey said there was a point on the Yukon River when he wondered if he was even still in contention for a top finish.
There was a time in this race where I thought I had a very small market share when it came to who has the chance at winning this thing.
Seavey says he was looking over his shoulder all night on the roughly 75-mile run from Koyuk. He anticipates doing the same on his way to Nome.
It's a habit. I know, it's a habit. I can't help it. I've been surprised too many times. You're watching for one team and another team pops up out of somewhere.
39 minutes later, Dallas Seavey's father, Mitch, drove his dog team into White Mountain. He smiled widely at the idea of racing against his son.
I don't mean it as a cliche, but I have two chances to win, and it's, you know, I'd a lot rather win myself, of course. I do everything I can. I'll give him nothing for free, but including dogs or college education.
The older Seavey knows it will be hard to make up the time he needs to catch the younger Seavey's team.
Makes it fun. Makes it very cool to be here, both of us. Unless there's a big earthquake, one of us is going to win, it looks like.
A big earthquake or something like it is exactly what Brent Sass needs. He's currently poised to finish in a solid third place, but he does have an outside chance to finish even higher.
With what it is now, I have to have a spectacular run and they have to have something go wrong, is basically what has to happen at this point, but anything is possible.
Regardless of the time gap between teams, Sass says he won't stop racing until his dogs cross under the burled arch.
Oh no, I mean, they're still sitting here, right? They haven't left yet. And I'm not that far behind, so. And I've been, you know, going back and forth with them for the last few hundred miles, so can't ever give up, that's for sure.
The next 77 miles will be some of the most competitive in this year's race. Whether they're some of the most competitive miles mushed in the race's history won't be decided until the teams reach Nome. On the Iditarod Trail, I'm Emily Schwing in White Mountain.
Former Alaska Governor Sarah Palin made a surprise appearance at a rally for Donald Trump in Florida today. Despite canceling a solo event after her husband Todd was injured in a snow machine accident north of Wasilla last night. Todd Palin's father told the Associated Press that his son suffered 8 fractured ribs and other injuries, but is expected to make a full recovery. In Florida, Sarah Palin said her husband's wreck only made her more determined to campaign for Trump and waded into the controversy over violence at Trump's rallies.
It makes me appreciate the time that we have to spend in doing something so worthy, and that's to get Donald J. Trump elected president. And what we don't have time for is all that petty, punk little thuggery stuff that's been going on with these quote-unquote protesters.
That audio courtesy of Right Side Broadcasting. Trump has been criticized by other Republican candidates for violence at his events. Meanwhile, Trump has struck a nerve among some Western conservatives with his answer to a question on public lands, APRN's Liz Ruskin reports.
A reporter for the magazine Field and Stream did an interview with Trump in late January in Las Vegas.
I'd like to talk about public land. 70% of hunters in the West hunt on public lands, land managed by the federal government. Right now, there's a lot of discussion about the federal government transferring those lands to states, divesting of that land. Is that something you would support as president?
I don't like the idea because I want to keep the lands great, and you don't know what the state's going to do with them. Are they going to sell as soon as they get into a little bit of a trouble? And I don't think it's something that should be sold.
Wrong answer. At least according to U.S. Senator Dan Sullivan.
Mr. Trump looks obviously uninformed.
Sullivan says moving more land out of federal control is one of his top goals. Collectively, Alaska's all-Republican delegation has sponsored dozens of bills over the years to do that. Many are small parcels, like surplus property from an old Coast Guard Loran station in Tok, or larger chunks, including some 2,000 acres at Point Spencer near Nome, to the Bering Straits Native Corporation and the state, for possible development as a port. Alaska's sole House member, Don Young, has a bill that would require the Forest Service to convey up to 2 million acres to each state. Young, at a hearing on the bill, said the states can do a better job.
The worst managed lands in the United States by our government is the Forest Service lands.
That sort of bill, to wrest public lands away from the federal government, is part of a trend among conservative lawmakers in the West. Utah is trying to get 30 million acres of federal land. The state's legislature passed a law demanding the federal government turn over the land and then pledged millions of dollars to press its legal case. In the Alaska legislature, House Speaker Mike Chenault sponsored a bill modeled after the Utah approach, requiring the federal government to transfer land to the state by the start of next year. Democratic Senator Bill Willakowski of Anchorage questioned the point of it at a hearing in Juneau last month.
I mean, we're basically saying the United States shall relinquish title to its public land, which would be great, right? Except I suspect that on January 1st, 2017, the United States government's not going to do that. And so is it the administration's proposal to send in the National Guard, start arresting federal agents? What's your plan to enforce this statute if it's ever on the books?
An aide to Chenault said he didn't expect any enforcement like that, but asserted the state would be a better manager of the real estate he says the feds have locked up. Naturally, conservation groups don't like this new movement.
We don't think we should privatize any federal lands, that these lands belong to all Americans.
Ethan Manuel, public lands director for the Sierra Club, now finds himself in the unexpected position of agreeing with Republican frontrunner Donald Trump.
We were shocked that he said that. On the one hand, it was good. On the other hand, it was surprising to hear that from Donald Trump.
Trump's challengers aren't with him on this. Senator Ted Cruz pounced. After Trump's statement to Field and Stream in Las Vegas, Cruz released a video ad.
85% of Nevada is owned and regulated by the federal government, and Donald Trump wants to keep big government in charge. That's ridiculous.
And Trump may not be all that committed to his position either. He submitted an op-ed to Nevada newspapers complaining about the BLM's draconian control over lands there and its reluctance to sell at an affordable price. Senator Sullivan says he thinks Trump can be rehabilitated with more information.
Yeah, because it looked like, you know, he was kind of struggling and the answers seemed kind of all over the place.
Sullivan offered to take him around Alaska, which he thinks will convince him federal land ownership isn't all that great. Reporting from Washington, I'm Liz Ruskin.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, an Anchorage youth shelter makes a change to combat human trafficking.
When I got over my shock and anger and, you know, just sadness about that, I was committed to change that.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Support for Alaska Public Media's Energy News Desk comes from Bettesworth North, Architects and Planners, and the Atwood Foundation.
Join the Salmon Project this month as they highlight the salmon lives of Alaskans in communities across the state. Find them on Facebook or visit salmonlife.org to make sure you don't miss these powerful stories. This message sponsored by the Salmon Project.
The Alaska Senate voted today on a state budget with $63 million more in cuts than the House budget passed last week. That's mainly because the Senate added about $100 million in executive branch cuts, though lawmakers didn't specify what exactly those cuts will be. Fairbanks Republican Pete Kelly says the legislature can work out the specifics before the end of the session.
This $100 million was mostly a recognition of those kinds of structural changes. Medicaid reform is a pretty good example. We somewhere in the neighborhood of $31 million this year, and up to over $100 million each year after that later on.
Before the vote, minority Democrats proposed restoring money for several programs, including senior benefits, pre-K, and inflation-proofing the permanent fund. They proposed paying for those changes in part by cutting oil and gas tax credits and reducing spending on several stalled infrastructure projects. But all of those amendments failed. Anchorage Democrat Berta Gardner says the state can afford the education funds she included in one amendment.
This amendment chooses education and Alaska's children over projects that may once have been a great idea, but that we simply can't afford anymore. The amendment restores pre-K education online with libraries, the teacher mentor program, and the unallocated $10 million university cut.
Gardner proposed offsetting the cost of her amendment with cuts to the Knik Arm Crossing, the Susitna-Watana Hydroelectric Dam, and the Ambler Mining District Road. Eagle River Republican Anna McKinnon says it would be wrong to use cuts to construction projects to pay for budget items that will pop up every year.
We have tough decisions to make, and I appreciate scrubbing the budget and looking at one-time funding to fulfill reoccurring costs, but it's just not the way to do business. You do not take one-time money and invest it in reoccurring costs. It just means we're going to have to face the same battle next year.
The Senate bill also includes $25 million more for the University of Alaska, but it would cost less than the House in other areas, including $8 million less for health and social services and $7 million less for transportation. The two houses will resolve their differences in a conference committee, but before the conference committee is assigned, both houses will consider major changes to oil and gas tax credits and the permanent fund, as well as Medicaid and criminal justice overhauls. Scientists are increasingly worried about the possibility of more die-offs and other adverse effects on marine mammals and seabirds if the suspected cause, a huge anomaly of warm water in the Northeast Pacific Ocean, persists into this summer. KTOO's Matt Miller has more in the first of a two-part series.
Biologists and ecologists reported on their latest observations at a two-day workshop held in January on the University of Washington campus. The conference was a follow-up to a similar gathering held last May near San Diego that primarily featured oceanographers, marine researchers, and climatologists.
Just wanted to point out that 14 and 15 have been two of the warmest years on record for temperatures in coastal Alaska, and that this is fed back through the state and may even be responsible for increased wildfires in the past year.
That's Russell Hopcroft of the University of Alaska Fairbanks School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences commenting on the possible environmental and economic impacts of the warm water anomaly that has lingered in the Northeast Pacific Ocean for the last 2 years. One leading theory being considered by marine researchers and biologists centers on the warm water mass's apparent ability to deprive fish, seabirds, and seaweed of their normal food sources. Water temperatures down to a depth of 300 feet have ranged from 2 to 8 degrees Fahrenheit above normal. The layer of warm water on top of cold water can create stratification of the water column, in which plankton and nitrate nutrients are prevented from rising to the surface. This is Richard Dewey of Ocean Networks Canada and the University of Victoria.
Certainly the salmon returning this year, the pinks that only go out for 2 years, so they were out in 2014 and 15, were coming back about half weight. The herring are half weight, and so The Northeast Pacific has been pretty malnourished, and I think the nourishment comes from the wind mixing of nutrients up into the Gulf of Alaska.
Warm water copepods are a form of plankton, which have fewer lipids or less fat content than cold water species. Bill Peterson is an oceanographer at National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration's Newport Research Station in Oregon. And for the first time in his over 30-year career, Peterson says 11 new species of warm water copepods just appeared on the West Coast.
The copepods tell us that water came from a long ways away. Where it came from, I don't know, but it's an issue we have to solve, I think, is this water just didn't just sit there and warm up. It came from someplace different.
As an example, an alarming spike in sea lion strandings along the California coast over the last 2 years may be caused in part by the incoming mass of warm water. Upwelling of ocean water near the coast would normally stir up cold water copepods that may be a major food source for sardines and anchovies. That upwelling was reduced dramatically or completely overwhelmed when the warm water mass moved right up to the shoreline. Sardine and anchovy populations relocated northward to find food, and sea lions may have been deprived of a major food source for themselves and their pups. It's possible such breakdowns in the marine food web were also the cause of the extraordinary number of whale strandings, as many as 30 reported along Alaska's coastline last year. There's also the near-complete collapse of the pollock hatchling population around Kodiak Island and this winter's die-off of over 22,000 common murres in Alaska. Art Miller, research oceanographer at Scripps Institute of Oceanography in La Jolla, California, had this observation.
Warm anomalies have persisted for more than 2 years, and it looks like the real killer was the second year, so that perhaps the animals could be resilient to, you know, one bad year, but if they start stacking them up, that things could get precipitously worse.
Of course, correlation does not necessarily mean causation. Whale and seabird die-offs, for example, have not yet been conclusively linked to the lack of forage. Scientists want to do more research before pinning any blame on the blob or even going as far as suggesting that the phenomenon is a product of climate change. Reporting in Juneau, I'm Matt Miller.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, proud supporter of APRN and dedicated to having conversations that help businesses and individuals succeed financially, because an open dialogue can open doors. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far. And by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. Love Alaska's fish? Consider supporting healthy fisheries and the Alaska Marine Conservation Council when filing for the 2016 PFD through the Pick, Click, Give program. This message sponsored by the AMCC.
Many of the Iditarod's most accomplished mushers are struggling with this year's trail. This morning, Lance Mackey scratched in Galena, citing personal health concerns. And Martin Boozer took a spill on the way into Unalakleet that had him blacking out from pain. Alaska Public Media's Zachariah Hughes caught up with Boozer to see how he'll make the remainder of his trip to Nome.
Just before Old Woman Cabin, I fell and bruised the back of my leg really, really hard. And passed out a few times. I couldn't come to, so I just rested. Well, I'm sorry, buddy. I just rested up there until I could bear the pain and moseyed on in here. And
what caused the fall?
That was just the fall. Second of misconcentration, I guess.
But you're not going to scratch?
No, I can't scratch. That would be like quitting. I can't quit.
I'm just curious. I mean, you've won this race, and you've placed so high so many times, but why you can't quit, or what do you have to prove
by
getting there?
I got to prove that when you start something, you want to see it through. And I kind of want to do this for my son, who the last, since January 22nd, has a hell of a lot more to overcome than I have.
That was four-time Iditarod champ Martin Boozer. His son is recovering from a bad car accident in Seattle. As the Iditarod advances toward an early Tuesday morning finish in Nome, stay up to speed with overnight race coverage on our website at alaskapublic.org. Homeless youth are often targets for human trafficking, forced to trade sex to meet basic needs like food, clothing, and shelter. Covenant House, a youth shelter in Anchorage, wants to protect young people, but the facility used to inadvertently contribute to the problem. KSKA's urban affairs reporter Ann Hillman learned now they're helping solve it. And it all starts with a door.
According to Covenant House International, about 25% of homeless youth are survivors of human trafficking. Allison Kerr is the executive director of the program in Anchorage.
Someone may say, let me take you to get your nails done. Let me take you to get your hair done. And the next thing you know, they find themselves in a situation where they can't leave.
She says she learned about the severity of the trafficking problem about 7 years ago during a presentation by the FBI and the Anchorage Police Department.
And in this presentation, they said the number one spot that young people were victimized or recruited from was Covenant House. And when I got over my shock and anger and, just sadness about that, I was committed, as were they, to change that.
Kerr says part of the solution was creating a place where young people felt safe and wanted to hang out. The shelter's old, cramped facility near Town Square Park wasn't exactly inviting. When the nearly 30-year-old organization built a new building about 2 years ago, they wanted input from young people on ways to get more kids in the door. One teen told Kerr to think about the placement of the literal door.
We might have the courage to walk into your building, but there are people that watch us doing this. And if you make it across the alley and you put a lot of cameras on there, then we know that we're safe when we're walking into your space.
So that's what they did. The main entrance is off the narrow side alley, not on A Street, a busy thoroughfare where it's hard to keep track of vehicles that linger abnormally. Kids can get there off different side streets, too. Covenant House employee Jennifer LaChance says she loves it.
So it pulls the youth away from the traffic, but what it also does is it allows us opportunity to monitor who comes down this alley. And so when we're seeing a particular vehicle come down this alley over and over again, staff become aware of it, and then it's something that we watch. And if we need to report it to APD, we will.
LaChance leads me past the door towards the spaces where the kids hang out, like a music room filled with ukuleles and an art room stocked with supplies. We wander into an airy gym with a towering rock wall. LaChance says all of these spaces provide the clients with outlets for their stress and frustration.
So a great example would be a youth who is feeling trapped because they're stuck here in the shelter and they just want to leave. Instead of them having to leave and go run around outside, this space allows them, if it's late at night, let's go to the gym. Let's go shoot some hoops. Let's go run some laps. Let's go climb the rock wall. It's a great alternative.
LaChance knows about needing outlets. She first came to Covenant House more than a decade ago. She was an angry 15-year-old who had been sent to live with her aunt, and it wasn't working out.
Both my parents said, we don't want her, which was heartbreaking for me. I truly felt unwanted, unworthy, and kind of forgotten about, to be honest. And the staff at Covenant House reminded me daily that I was worth it.
She says she maintained her relationships with Covenant House staff even when she left Alaska for school and AmeriCorps. Kerr says those are the types of relationships that will ultimately keep young people safe from traffickers. And the organization's new building attracts three times the number of kids who used to go to the old place. Kerr says they serve about 2,500 individuals per year. Some just drop in, others stay the night. They can get help finding a job or a jacket or a medical checkup. Kerr says she can't say for sure if the new resources in the new space are reducing the number of people who are trafficked, but
there is an uptake in us being able to catch the perpetrators. There's an uptake in us being able to engage a young person and keep them safe from it.
More kids are walking through the door. From the Urban Affairs Desk, I'm Ann Hillman.
More than a dozen educators from around the state met at Sitka High School recently to learn how to make shop and engineering classes more engaging. Supported by a grant from the Alaska Department of Education, the group had a few days to build and wire their very own electric guitars. KCAW's Brielle Schaefer has the story.
Right now, I'm just cutting out the head of my guitar into the shape that I want, or the basic shape that I want, and then I'm going to go in and sand it down to make it exactly how it's supposed to turn out.
Casey Evans is a sophomore at Petersburg High School, and he's joined teachers in learning how to make an electric guitar from scratch. Casey is fascinated by computer-aided design software. His teacher sent him to Sitka for the workshop so he could bring these skills back to the classroom. Before Casey started taking industrial arts classes, he thought he would go into a field where he could use his hands, like diesel mechanics, he says. But digital fabrication introduced him to other possible careers.
Kind of opened possibilities to engineering or design or manufacturing and just stuff like that.
The classes are hands and brains on. Randy Huey, retired Sitka High School career and technical education coordinator, secured the state grant, which funded the professional development course. Teachers from the Lower 48, one whose class helped design a custom Seahawks guitar for Microsoft co-founder Paul Allen, flew up to teach it. Huey says in CAD classes 20 years ago, students used technology to draft blueprints of houses. His students were mostly disinterested because it was something intangible to them. Only when he started having his classes design their own logos for stickers did his students become more engaged.
My enrollment tripled in 1 year because we were suddenly doing something that was tactile and they were interested in having.
Expanding on that idea, Huey thought students would be excited to apply design concepts to building their own electric guitars. But before they could get into the fab lab, teachers needed to learn how to do it first. Carl Jordan is the woodshop teacher at Blatchley Middle School.
We're doing electrical, we're soldering stuff. There's a bunch of parts and pieces that I don't even know what they're called because I'm learning how to do it as we go.
In the end, after some trial and error, the group had fully functional instruments that they were excited to bring back to their classrooms. Now they just need to learn how to play them. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Brielle Schaefer.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. Like us on Facebook at Alaska Public Media and follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Emily Schwing and Zachariah Hughes on the Iditarod Trail, Ann Hillman in Anchorage, Brielle Schaefer in Sitka, Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., and Andrew Kitchenman and Matt Miller in Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Wesley Early is our web editor, and I'm Rachel Waldholz. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
the Red Dog Mine, committed to environmental excellence. At Alaska Pacific University, you will be inspired by the beauty of Alaska, motivated by devoted faculty, and surrounded by independent-minded, creative students pursuing their higher education goals. There's no time like the present to find out what they are all about. It's time to experience APU. Hashtag, this is our classroom. This message sponsored by Alaska Pacific University.
The Elder Mentor Program is designed to bring the wisdom, cultural values, and resilience of Alaskan elders into the classroom and into the community by supporting educators and children. They're looking for low-income elders, age 55 or older, to serve as positive, supportive role models for children. Elder Mentors serve through the National Senior Corps Program. Mentor information at ruralcap.com. This message is sponsored by the Rural Alaska Community Action Program.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.